May it please the court. My name is Tasha Marie Stevens. I'm with the law firm of Fuqua, Urey & Willard, and I represent the appellant, who was the defendant below, Mr. Klein Valentine. If the court would allow, I will proceed with my argument without any formal recital of the facts.
That's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. The defense asserts that the trial court abused its discretion in this matter by finding that a prior statement of the testifying officer, who would have been Sergeant Nicholas Couch, was not a Jenks statement, or that the defendant was not entitled to that statement either prior to the trial or during the trial after he was presented and testified on direct examination. The basis for the defendant's assertion that he was entitled to those statements was, number one, it was requested in discovery.
When you say statement, are you talking about the transcription of the dialogue that the officer was having over the radio, the police radio?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. That wasn't
a formal statement. That was a real-life event that happened to be transcribed.
Yes, Your Honor. It was, according to the officer, he had called in the stop and remained on the line with dispatch in real time, observing events and giving dispatch the information as to what he was observing, what the defendant was doing at the time. They were in pursuit of his vehicle, if he would turn right. He testified that he said whatever the car was doing, he was describing that to dispatch.
All right. Well, the position of the state is that had you asked for it, your client asked for it in pretrial discovery, they would have given it to you, but you didn't. And although there were two enumerated requests, they were so broad that they wouldn't have put any reasonable person on notice that that transcription is what you were looking for. What is your response to that?
Your Honor, my response is that 19 and 20 did in fact put them on notice.
The case turns on that?
No, Your Honor. Even in spite of that, when the officer testified that he made these statements during the trial, we were entitled at that point, when I requested from the state the statements, that they should have given them to me pursuant to Jenks.
Well, in other words, even if you didn't put them on notice, once the testimony identified that transcription,
yes, Your Honor,
then the trial should have been stopped and the state should have gotten the transcription and brought it back.
Our position is the state should have made an inquiry as to whether these recordings existed, if there were any prior statements, and they should have made an inquiry into that and had that available.
But why should the state have made an inquiry?
It's their job.
If we assume that questions or production demands 19 and 20 didn't put them on notice, that's what you wanted.
Well, if there's any prior statements that falls within that qualify as a statement pursuant to Jenks, then it would be incumbent upon them to have that available at trial so that if defense counsel makes that request, they can provide it.
Well, everyone knows generally, don't they, that police officers who are on foot patrol will have a radio and perhaps mm-hmm. a microphone attached to their shoulder, and police officers in patrol cars are routinely reporting what they are doing to dispatch and getting instructions from dispatch. The defense would be on notice, or at least constructive notice, of all of that. Isn't that true?
It is, Your Honor. We would be on constructive notice that an officer, if he stops or gets out of his vehicle, is going to inform dispatch, I'm stopping or I'm stopping a car for X, Y, and Z reasons.
Well, that's a statement, isn't it?
From
your perspective?
It is a statement. Does it turn on the officer's credibility? Does it touch on what he's testifying to? Generally, yes, it does. But in this case, we have more than that situation of him saying, there's a car in the park and I'm stopping it. He continues that conversation, which in real time is when he's describing the events that are occurring.
Well, okay, there may be conversations or recordings of the communications that are more detailed than others, but if we accept your argument, won't there have to be routine transcriptions of all the 9/11 dispatches and production of that in every single case?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that there would have to be.
Why not?
The recordings should be inquired into to see if they meet any of the requirements of the constitutional law. Is there Brady information included in them? And when you have a recording of that nature, generally there's something called a detailed call for service report with it. Before you even listen to that, you can review, or the state could review, that detailed call for service report to see what's going to be included in the recording. If they make that inquiry, they'll know, well, this is something that may trigger a Brady obligation and may trigger a Giglio obligation. I should listen to this, and I may have to provide it either at trial, or if I choose to, I can provide it before trial.
How can anyone know if the transcription, whether you call it a statement or not, is potential Brady material unless somebody who's legally trained listens to it? Your position imply that every time there's a 9/11 dialogue that's transcribed, somebody is going to have to listen to it and legally analyze it, all of them?
Well, I believe that's their duty anyway, Your Honor. Any time that I've, in misdemeanor cases, I routinely get dispatch records. So on a DUI case, I'm going to get dispatch records. If somebody else calls in,
When that has happened, you have made a specific request for them?
I have submitted the same discovery that I submitted in this case.
One of the things that interests me about the trial judge's analysis was everything seemed to focus on the word statement.
Yes,
whether,
Your Honor.
Whether this recording of the communication was a statement or was not a statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
What does that really have to do with anything? Your request says information relating to the credibility of any prosecution witness. Now, it's inconceivable to me that a deputy attorney general would not interview a police officer before trial, or immediately after discovery was filed, or a police report prepared by that officer, and not determine that if there was an ongoing dialogue between the police officer and KentCom, they would want to know what that police officer said, because they were going to have to present that same police officer as the lead prosecution witness at trial, and they would be looking for inconsistencies in order to prepare properly to meet them. Importantly, in this case, as I understand it, the police officers testified that there was a siren on at all times,
Your Honor, yes,
while they were pursuing your client. And your client was charged among a number of piddling offenses, which offend anyone who has a sense of cost of prosecution. He was charged with an important offense, failure to stop at the command of a police officer. And one of the most serious factual concerns is, in considering the fact the police were in an unmarked vehicle, a pickup truck, not typically thought of as a police car,
yes, Your Honor.
It's not inconceivable that a well-prepared prosecutor would want to know whether, in fact, that recording documented that indeed it was true, that the siren was on at all times. It's critical, it seems to me, for the jury is to have a basis to determine whether the police officer testified accurately that the siren was all on at all times, so they could determine that this defendant did indeed know that it was a police vehicle and not a black pickup truck that was chasing him. Now, you asked for information relating to the credibility of a prosecution witness. Where is it written that you have to immediately specify all possible information in detail that may relate to the credibility of a prosecution witness?
It is not, Your Honor. It's not written anywhere, and that is why we cast a broad net. Based on experience, normally it's going to be recordings or police reports or statements of things of that nature. We can't think of everything, so we say any statements that lend itself to the credibility of the witness, including inconsistent statements, or try to cast a wide net so that you do cover everything, and the trial court said that it's too broad. It's not specific enough.
I know what the trial judge said, and I'm trying to figure out why the trial judge was so narrowly focused, because your request in paragraph 19 says disclosure of statements, interviews, reports, or other information relating to the credibility of any prosecution witness. It doesn't say statements related to the credibility of any prosecution witness.
Yes, Your Honor.
How are you to know what that material might be with exactitude?
And, Your Honor, that was part of my issue with them saying, well, why didn't you ask for the dispatch records yourself? There was nowhere in the police reports or anywhere else where the officer said he called SUSCOM and stayed on the line with him and described anything. The state actually, in their presentation, said, we didn't know about it. We didn't ask for it. If she had asked us for it, we would have asked for it. How was I to know about the dispatch records that, or I'm sorry, the statement to dispatch that continued without any inclination or any sign from the officer?
Is there anything in Rule 16 which purportedly defines the scope of discovery that parties must provide that would bar the state from providing this information to you on some theory that you're not entitled to it?
No, Your Honor, but when I presented that to the court, that we asked for the information, if the state was going to say that we weren't entitled to it, they would have to object and state why they were objecting. That answer was not given. The answer that was given was that we will provide it once received.
Well, did you get any indication that anyone working for the state ever made an inquiry to determine whether there was other information relating to the credibility of any prosecution witness?
No, not to my knowledge.
Let's turn to the information itself. We now know the state did supply tape or the transcription. I'm not sure which. And the question I have is there anything on that tape relates to the credibility of the police officer? Is there anything exculpatory
in
that information?
The fact that the officers testified that they had their lights on, they had their sirens on. One officer testifies, and I believe it was Sergeant Couch, testifies that at one point he was yelling out of the window, "Stop police," during the chase. You listen to the entire recording, and it was a recording of CD, and you never hear a siren, though there's back and forth communication from dispatch and from the officer. Not at any point during that communication do you hear a siren, and at no point do you hear the officer yelling, "Stop police." So the fact that...
So the absence of any noise?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and that would have definitely been something that I would have used
at
trial.
But that's a different issue from a statement of the officer, isn't it? I mean, the absence of a siren is not a statement out of the officer's mouth.
No, but it's within the statement. I mean, the statement is there. He's talking about the background. He testifies about what's going on, and then the statement is not consistent with what he testifies to is going on.
Why are we focused on whether it's a statement or not? Your request says, or. Something other than is what or means to me.
Yes, Your Honor.
A statement. And it's information relating to the credibility of any prosecution witness. Why wouldn't this tape, which arguably has no sound of a siren, does not document, in fact is inconsistent with, the police officer's testimony about what he did to put your client on notice that he has failed to stop at the command of a police officer, why isn't that discoverable? Why wasn't it presented to you before trial? So you could listen to the tape and prepare accordingly. What does this concept of a statement have to do with it at all?
Your Honor, I think that the reason that the court focused on a statement was because in our request in number 20, we mentioned statements pursuant to Jenks. And since Jenks focuses on statements that would be due after direct examination, the court kind of honed in on the statement.
So as a practical matter, the difference is, isn't it, that the statement of the officer is only subject to production for cross-examination after his direct examination, correct? Whereas if it was discoverable as the absence of a siren or something like that and is not a statement, you would be entitled to that prior to trial. Is that true?
It is. I mean, Jenks only requires production of the statements as is defined within Rule 26.2.
Well, is it your position that to the extent that the evidence of the tape is something other than a statement, you would be entitled to that prior to trial?
Yes, because it was inconsistent with what the officer reported in his report and subsequently testified to.
Okay.
I wouldn't have known his subsequent testimony, but what he put in his report, that tape was not consistent with
that. My next question is, why did you not move to compel production of that?
I wasn't aware it existed.
All right.
The only thing I was aware of was that the officer stopped, and he would have said, "I'm stopping here because I see a car."
Well, the real question here in my mind is, where does the duty lie to respond to a request for discovery that's consistent with what Rule 16 contemplates? When the state gets the request, doesn't the burden shift to the state to determine whether there is information that ought to be disclosed that is consistent with the discovery request. And what evidence is there, what was presented at trial to suggest that the state made an effort to determine whether there was other information that related to the credibility of their prosecution witnesses?
I think the state has an ongoing duty.
What evidence is that they did anything in response to that portion of your request?
There is none. The only thing I have is their answer saying we'll supply it when it's received. They don't identify what it is or if they're aware that something existed, and that's a pretty routine answer.
Excuse me. Could you articulate your theory of prejudice? That is, what is the prejudice that rises to the level as to require reversal?
In this case, there were two officers that testified, and my client also testified. Officer Couch, when he testified, if I had had this information, I would have most definitely cross-examined him, and a lot of what he said a jury would have considered and more than likely may have taken a different view as to how they were going to rule.
Well, it's the more than likely that we ought to focus on.
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the support for more than likely?
If you have an officer saying, I approached this gentleman in a pickup truck, it was 11:47 at night, he shouldn't have been in a park, we tried to stop him, and you have him testifying, I was sitting in a park, a black pickup truck pulls up with his headlights on, I got out of Dodge because I thought somebody was trying to rob me or going to attack me or something, I was scared, so I left. So if this officer's saying, no, my lights were on, my sirens were on, and then there's a recording where the sirens aren't on, that would cause a jury to question everything else the officer testified to. So it's effective cross-examination that just couldn't take place.
Let me say it in my own words and tell me if I have it right.
Okay.
You're saying that the record without that cross-examination is basically undisputed testimony by the officer that he had a siren on and his lights flashing, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you repeat that for me? I'm sorry.
Without the benefit of the cross-examination.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
There was the jury mm-hmm. heard undisputed testimony by the officer that your client was fleed after the officer said police, stop police, and also that the officer had on the police flashing lights.
Right. But no, Your Honor, my client didn't contest it because he did testify. And he said when the truck approached, there weren't any lights on except for the headlights. There wasn't a siren on. That wasn't until way later when they went into the development.
Okay.
So he did testify to that, but
there was disputed evidence.
There was
disputed evidence.
Yes,
okay, then the question is, who do you believe?
Yes, Your Honor.
And your argument is, had I had the chance to cross-examine the officer based on the information that was implicit in the statement, that may have tipped the balance of credibility.
Yes, either that or the court would have had to strike that officer's testimony, so which would have been even better for my client because the state didn't meet its requirement to produce, and that's under Jenks 26.2.
That's different from cross-examination.
Yes, Your Honor. It's a lot different.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, please, Your Honors. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Abby Adams on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honor, the State would like to clarify a few things with respect to these dispatch recordings. But first also say the Superior Court did not abuse its discretion in denying Valentin's motion. The Court, however, does not need to reach this Jenks Rule 26.2 discovery issue because any error here was harmless well beyond a reasonable doubt. Even if you struck that officer's testimony, there was a second officer in the truck who never spoke to dispatch, who testified about all of the events that occurred that day. Valentin testified to facts and admitted to almost every single charge. And in his Mirandized statement, which would not have been suppressed, he told the officer, not the officer that had talked to dispatch, but the other officer, that he fled from them because he knew that he thought they were park police and they thought they wouldn't chase him. With this overwhelming evidence, the court does not have to reach this Jenks discovery issue. Even so, Your Honors, I would like to clarify a few things, about this dispatch recording. this is not anything like an MVR. This is not a blow-by-blow.
What does MVR stand for?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's not like a motor vehicle recording, which is the video in an officer's car, which is intended to capture the events that happen on the stop. This is a dispatch recording. There are many factual questions that would need to be resolved to find out whether or not there actually is any Brady evidence among this, contrary to what counsel has stated. First of all, dispatch court communications, which are standard operating procedures for officers, as Justice Ridgely pointed out, whenever an officer contacts any individual, whatever they do, they have to inform dispatch of where they are and what they're doing. That is the purpose of these recordings, and they are snippets. The radio only transmits when they transmit something. And if you listen to the recording, the 4 minutes during the chase, it is not a blow-by-blow of what happened in this stop, or attempted stop, when he fled. The only information that the officer is informing dispatch of is, I'm going to make the stop. He attempts to call in the information that's standard when they say they're going to make a stop. And then he reports that he fled. So dispatch then calls for backup.
I listened to the recording. There's a lot of blank time on there. Now, why wouldn't, if the officer is transmitting and a siren is running at the same time, why wouldn't that come over the radio and be recorded?
It's my understanding that these recordings, it only transmits something. I mean, this is a police radio. Different officers from Delaware State Police, DENREC, can listen to this. You only transmit when you make the actual transmission. Otherwise, it's silent so that someone else can be on the airwaves. You would not keep it.
But why wouldn't it pick up background sound or of a siren, for instance?
I spoke to someone at KentCom about that.
Is this in the record?
No, it's not.
No. So the record doesn't reveal that?
I can say the record does not reveal this. It's my understanding, based on general practice, like Your Honor had said, that it would depend on a variety of factors. I know from past cases that officers sometimes turn off the siren briefly when they make a dispatch communication so that dispatch can hear them. If, depending on the vehicle, that sort of thing, how much noise you can hear actually in the vehicle, what radio, how close the radio is to their mouth, that type of thing.
Does the record reflect whether this radio was, one, attached to the officer's shoulder, or is this one some kind of handheld thing attached to the car?
It does not. Listening to it, listening to the recording, it appears to me that it is his lapel. But again, that's a factual question that perhaps should be resolved by the Superior Court if this court determined to remand it to resolve those issues.
Did anyone from the Attorney General's office inquire about the existence of this dispatch recording to determine whether there was anything material in it that related to the officer's description of the incident before trial?
No, Your Honor.
No one made a judgment that it existed, but that it didn't contain any information that was subject to discovery as requested in paragraph 19.
As Justice Ridgely points out, I think that everyone is aware that these dispatches occur in every case.
Just answer my question. Does the record reflect whether a Deputy Attorney General examined the request for discovery, made an inquiry to determine whether there was any information available that would relate to the credibility of the police officers that would be called, who would testify about the circumstances and facts surrounding a chase which would support a charge, a serious charge, a fare to stop at the command of a police officer, when that charge depended upon their testimony that there was a siren on at all times and that the police officers yelled out of the truck, stop, because they realized they were in an unmarked vehicle and it was dark?
No, Your Honor. The prosecutor also had access to the blow-by-blow in the police report and the Miranda statement of the defendant, where he admitted that he fled the police officers because he thought they were park police and they wouldn't chase him. So it was reasonable for the prosecutor to not affirmatively seek out a dispatch recording.
So the prosecutor basically decides not whether I'm required to respond to discovery, but the prosecutor decides whether, if I were to respond to discovery, in my judgment, it would or would not be helpful to the defense. So the prosecutor either did or would have made the judgment that because of the statement in the Miranda interview, since it was inconsistent with anything other than that it was consistent with guilt, the prosecutor just decided there's no point in making any further inquiry.
The prosecutor did not have a duty to inquire about these particular recordings based on the facts of this case. As the Superior Court found, defense counsel gave this broad discovery request, which called for many items that would not be required under Rule 16. This would not be required under Rule 16.
Did the state therefore file an objection on the basis that it was overbroad?
No, Your Honor, nor did defense counsel in her motion in limine, which got other charges thrown out just prior to trial, address any idea that that she believed there were other information that might fall within her discovery request that was not provided.
Okay, so your position, and therefore the state's position, is the state can decide whether or not they have to respond to discovery based on it being overbroad without objecting, simply because it would have been inconvenient and it's not the custom.
Not simply because it would have been inconvenient, Your Honor. The Superior Court found that this prosecutor had not been put on reasonable notice that these dispatch recordings were what the prosecutor saw in that extremely broad discovery request. And so the prosecutor did not obtain them. He said that he would have given them, and Sussex County Prosecutor's Office typically has an open discovery policy, but it shouldn't be held against them that, you know, he said he would have given them to her if she had asked. He just was not on notice. He did not make an affirmative judgment that he didn't need to do this. He just did not.
When did the state know that the recording had been made and it may have contained information inconsistent with the testimony the state intended to offer through two police officers at trial?
Well, I think that everyone, well, defense counsel at trial said that she was not aware that dispatch recordings took place.
Could you speak a little louder or into the mic?
I'm sorry. Defense counsel at trial said that she was not aware that the dispatch recordings had taken place, but I think generally the prosecutors, everyone would know that a dispatch recording had taken place. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I want to answer your question, but now the second part of it has, if you could please.
Okay. Basically, it's almost a rhetorical question. What I'm trying to get at is, what really is the affirmative duty of a prosecutor to seek the truth at trial, and in doing so, respond to discovery in a way that's reasonable and consistent with the wording of the discovery request? It should be obvious by now, I don't think the trial judge's focus on whether this was a statement or not has anything to do with the first argument, and that is whether the request for production, the discovery request itself before trial, had been met, and met fairly. And the first part of that is, was there a fair inquiry made by the prosecutor to determine whether there was any evidence available that would relate to the credibility of the witnesses the prosecutor planned to call? I assume the prosecutor read the police report, knew generally how he or she would establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt for failure to stop at the command of a police officer, would readily determine that it's critical that there be evidence that a siren was on, and that the police officer said, stop, we're the police, or words to that effect, because the police were at night in a black truck, an unmarked vehicle. So, if there's a recording, it seems logical that you would want to know whether the recording would be consistent with the police officer's testimony you planned to introduce at trial.
Actually, Your Honor, I think getting to the actual crux of your issue, There was a question whether these are recorded. And when the opening brief was filed, so the prosecutor didn't necessarily know that they had been recorded. Just because someone...
I thought you said earlier everybody knew
that
these communications take place and there's a record of them.
I apologize, Your Honor. Everyone knows that the dispatch dispatch calls take place. Whether or not they're actually recorded in Kemp by KentCom was not known at that time. When the opening brief was filed, I asked the prosecutor for the recordings because obviously, you know, and the initial answer that we got was they aren't recorded. And then we tried to, we tried to get an affidavit to that effect that we could provide it with a supplemental motion to the court, and then it came out that they actually are recorded, and then that's when I received
Point is, the time for that inquiry to be made, it could be argued, is the time when the discovery request is received, because you make a determination how you're going to present your case, you know what your witnesses will testify to, and you've been asked, is there anything available that would cast some light on the credibility of the witnesses you're going to offer? It would seem to me a prosecutor would want to know whether, in fact, there was a recording that documented a siren was on at all times, or at least some of the time, if it is, as you described, an interrupted communication. They would want to know whether that recording captured the police officer saying, "Stop, we're the police." Why wasn't that an obligation of the prosecutor to make that inquiry and then produce it in response to discovery?
The prosecutor also had the information that Valentin admitted that he fled from police.
And this would be the first case in history where a defendant testified inconsistently with the pretrial statement.
He did not testify inconsistently.
No, but when you're preparing for trial, you don't take it for granted that the defendant's going to testify consistently with what the defendant may have said in a pretrial statement, do you? You anticipate every eventuality.
Your Honor, it's the state's position that the Superior Court was correct, that if defense counsel had actually contemplated getting these dispatch recordings in her broad discovery request, she would have included them in her motion in limine. She would have brought it up to the court the day of trial so that they could have been obtained. She would have brought it up at some point.
But contemplate something that you didn't even know about and your prosecutor didn't know about until you filed the opening brief on appeal?
Again, Your Honor, people are aware that the dispatch transmissions take place. Whether or not they're recorded is a different thing. If the defense counsel really felt that there was a recording of dispatch that fell within her discovery request, she could have asked for it at any point prior to trial. That doesn't to say, and the state should have objected, saying that her discovery request was overbroad.
Let's get the time sequence correct, or at least correct, clear for me. At the time that the discovery request was made, if I understand the position the state is taking, there was nothing on the face of those requests that identified this particular dispatch recording.
Exactly, and right. Unlike an NPR.
Okay, until some event took place later, the prosecutor, the deputy attorney general who tried the case, had no clue that it was being asked for, that it even existed. Is that fair?
He had no clue that the dispatch tapes were being asked for until it was raised at trial.
Okay. When it was raised at trial, what happened then?
When it was raised at trial, the judge looked at the discovery request. He asked defense counsel to point out where she requested it. She first said she was not aware that he had spoken with dispatch, which I think undercuts the idea that the...
Was not aware that it existed?
Was not aware that he had spoken to dispatch, which I think undercuts the idea that the discovery request itself sought dispatch recordings.
All right.
But the trial judge first looked at the discovery request, and they honed in on 19 and 20, and he contrasted that with, I believe it was number 7, where she where defense counsel specifically asked for MVR recordings, which was not applicable.
Yeah, but the trial judge found that this particular item was not asked for.
Yes, he found that the prosecutor was not reasonably
noticed. And then the trial proceeded.
Yes.
And go ahead.
It did not actually proceed. They also argued then whether it fell under Jenks.
All right.
And that at that point, the trial judge determined that, I believe his actual ruling was...
That it didn't, right?
It definitely did not fall under Jenks. He said he thought of Jenks as... I would not think of it as a statement. I would think of a statement as an investigative statement when you're talking to somebody.
So that's where we get into the statement issue.
Yes.
All right, then the trial proceeds to a verdict, correct?
Pardon me?
The trial then proceeds and a verdict is reached.
Yes.
What's the next event that took place, and when did that event occur that put everybody on notice that there was this problem?
When the opening brief was filed.
Opening brief on appeal?
Yes.
Okay. And then what happened?
When I saw the issue raised in the opening brief, I immediately saw whether or not these recordings of dispatch existed so that this court would be able to, make a determination. I was initially told by the prosecutor who inquired that they are not recorded. It's just something that happens, but they are not tape recorded.
And that turned out to be incorrect.
Yes. We sought then to get an affidavit from someone at KenCom about what happens with that process.
And KenCom would not give an affidavit that was consistent with what you were told.
Well, no, I guess when that process started, it was determined that, yes, they are recorded.
Okay.
And then it actually was not until the very week, days before the answering brief was due, that I obtained the dispatch.
Okay, so rightly or wrongly, the state did not, that is, the Department of Justice didn't know that this recording was in existence until some point during the appeal before you filed your answering brief.
Days before the answering brief was filed, yes.
Well, just so we're not confused about that, if the same inquiry had been made upon receipt of the discovery request before trial as the inquiry you made as you were preparing your opening brief, the state would have known that the recording existed before trial, wouldn't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
They simply didn't ask.
No, Your Honor. And it did require an attorney general subpoena for us to get the dispatch recordings.
Well,
in the discovery request number 19, other information relating to the credibility of any prosecution witness, including but not limited to inconsistent statements, reports, or prior testimony, doesn't that cover a recorded statement and the recording? May not have been as concise as or specific as an earlier request, but at least generically, doesn't it fit within that?
Well, I believe the Superior Court was correct that in using the same statement analysis that it used when it was talking about the jinx, which was that these aren't statements. They are, I see my time.
Is that fair? You can answer my question.
May I finish? These are not statements. They are not intended to provide a narrative, and they do not provide a narrative blow by blow of what happened in this stop. They do not do that. The Superior Court correctly found that these are not statements. They are not intended to be a correct.
Well, I read 19 as being 20. I read as the Jenks request, paragraph
yes.
20. And 19 is something else.
Yes, but I'm sorry. I was trying to directly answer your question, Your Honor. I believe that the trial court, and I don't think he abused his discretion in this, used 20 asked for Jenks, but 19 asked for statements. And he found he didn't believe that these were statements, and I don't believe he abused his discretion in that.
So he missed the word or after statements. It can't be statements.
It would generally fall within the other information relating to credibility. I apologize. Yes, it would.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, just briefly, Your Honor, I wanted to address that there was some question about the recordings, that there's dead space between when someone's speaking. Well, when someone's speaking, even when someone is speaking, you don't hear the background noise of a siren. So I just wanted to clear that up. There's dead space where no one's speaking and nothing's being heard. But even when someone is pushing a button and speaking to dispatch, you don't hear any kind of the background noise or any kind of sirens or anything. That's something we were focusing on.
Problem is, we don't. The record doesn't really reflect, you know, what happened.
Yes, Your Honor.
That is whether the radio was on the whole time, and in fact, but the siren had been deliberately turned off.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or some other permutation or combination. We don't know.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand.
Let me ask. Let's assume we agree with you on that. Which conviction does this, or charge, does this specifically impact? The convictions are failure to stop on the command of police. I assume it would be that one.
Yes, Your Honor.
Reckless driving, speeding, failure to stop at a stop sign, and entering after hours on division lands. How would that absence of a siren be relevant to those convictions?
Primarily, it's the felony charge, Your Honor, the failure to stop, the reckless driving. My client did admit that he did, I think, a rolling stop, which isn't a stop at a stop sign. I believe he admitted that he didn't stop at one of the stop signs, but primarily we're focused on the felony, the reckless driving. I think essentially that's it. He did admit that he was in the park after hours.
So the specific convictions that if we agree with you mm-hmm. that there would be a new trial on, please list them for me, 1, 2, 3. What are they?
If I can get just a second, just so I can see all of them. There were some that were not processed by the state, so I guess those are out of the picture also. Disregarding a police officer's signal. That was not processed. Reckless driving. He wasn't convicted on the failure to signals. The failure to remain stopped. And I think he admitted the speeding. So I believe that those three charges are the three that will be contested.
I can't resist asking you this question. Have you ever seen a fact situation where an individual is fleeing the police, in other words, failing to stop at the command of a police officer, who signaled to the police which direction he was going and came to a complete stop at a stop sign, then resumed fleeing?
No, Your Honor.
And the police nevertheless charged this individual with both failure to stop at the command of a police officer and these minor motor vehicle violations, as we in the trade call it.
Yes, Your Honor. And really with Mr. Valentin's testimony that he thought that this person was trying to get him, it could have been an excuse or a justification defense for his leaving the area so quickly and not going 25. And so we should be able to dispute those offenses also.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.